I was talking to one of my preaching brethren in connection with the topic I have today, and he made the statement that what could be more boring than to have to talk 45 minutes on one cup to a room full of one cup preachers. I told that to another preacher, and he said, "Oh, we'll love it." I like that, because I think sometimes we don't. And I'd like to just say a few things to introduce my thoughts. You know, I'm convinced that our lack of enthusiasm for our basic doctrines has done us a great deal of harm in the day that we live in. The basic doctrinal truths that we believe in have really motivated the church, at least in times past. It's given it zeal. And I think that the subjects that we're teaching on today is an area that has really been the foundation of what we're all about. It's been the foundation for our actions and really who we are. It's given us some identity, our opposition to the introduction of cups and multiple breads in the Lord's Supper. Because, you see, it was out of the fires of this controversy several years ago that our brotherhood was forged. And 50 years ago, we preached on what we're preaching on today all the time. And we did it with enthusiasm, and we were excited about it, and it meant a lot to us. And as a result of it, it gave us a great deal more interest, I think, brotherhood-wise, than probably we have today. And it seems to me that our loss of zeal in this day and age can be directly related to I think it's related to some extent our failure to preach on basic doctrine that identifies us. And it seems to me that we ought to get back to that. You know, the Apostle Paul one time says, "We having the same spirit of faith," he's referring back to David, "according as it is written," David's one originally wrote it, he says, "I have believed and therefore I have spoken." And then he concludes, "We also believe and therefore speak." Now, the conclusion of that is that if you believe something and you really believe it, you're going to tell people about it. You're going to talk about it. And so it seems to me that our failure to do it, now I know that we don't have the opposition we used to, but we need to deal with these subjects, and we need to teach them more, I think, than we do. And the fact that we don't, to me, is an indication, perhaps, of a loss of faith. So I'm glad that we have this on our agenda today, and I'm glad that I have been able to study on the subject and to be able to talk about it for a while. The brethren gave me two verses of Scripture, 1 Corinthians 10 and 16, 1 Corinthians 11 and 27, and they asked three questions about each of them. If you have the agenda, you can see what those questions are. And I'm going to deal basically with those questions and with those two verses of Scripture in my talk this morning. Now, there are a jillion questions that will come up about the Lord's Supper, and if during the question and answer session you want to ask some questions about that, I'll either try to answer them or I'll turn it over to some of these brethren who can. I'm going to deal, first of all, with 1 Corinthians 10 and 16. "The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ?" The first question that was asked is this: is the cup singular or plural in this verse of Scripture? Well, it's pretty obvious to we one cup people that it's singular. It's not cups. In fact, the word cups is not used in the New Testament, or it's not used in the Bible in reference to the Lord's Supper anywhere. Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper using one single cup, and it doesn't seem to me that that's difficult to understand. In fact, he put it in language that's simple. For example, in Matthew 26, 27, he says, "He took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, drink ye all of it." Mark 14, 23, "He took the cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank of it." Now, you don't have to have over a 58 IQ to understand that. It's pretty obvious, pretty apparent. And if people today would just obey the plain commands pertaining to the Lord's Supper, there'd be absolutely no problem about it. However, we know that that's not the case. When men wish to change that which is simple and that which is obvious, we have to revert to other methods to counteract that. And you know, we've talked a lot about hermeneutics and language and things this week. It's good that we have those things. They're necessary sometimes to delve into those things in order to counteract error. And that's exactly what we've had to do with reference to the cup and the bread and other things pertaining to the Lord's Supper. Well, is the cup singular or plural? Well, of course, we know that our cups brethren have resorted all kind of methods to try to prove that it's plural there. And one of the proof texts that they often go to is 1 Corinthians 10 and 16. And they claim that although the cup is singular here, it's used in reference to two congregations. They say insomuch that Paul was writing from Ephesus to Corinth, he uses the plural we in reference to the singular cup, and the we has to include at least two congregations, and therefore includes two cups. And I might just mention in passing here that although we do not believe that, and we think it's a bit of a frivolous way of trying to prove something, in just the last couple of years, there has been some leading brethren in our brotherhood that has been led off into digression basically on this argument. They swallowed this generic cup idea, you see. Now, there are several things wrong with this reasoning. First, we must recognize, and of course all of us do, that in the Bible, communion and worship and church function is observed congregationally. The function of the church is never intercongregational. It's never on a state basis or a national basis or a universal basis. It's always congregational. The church simply doesn't function in those other ways. The only way that it does is in a spiritual relationship to one another. That being the case, what does the we refer to when Paul says the cup of blessing which we bless? Well, Jameson Fawcett and Brown, is that the commentary, says on page 282 that the we in this verse of Scripture is we, the many believers, assembled. In other words, it's a congregational thing. Alford says on page 558, the we refers to the assembled. Now these, and I think I could find other scholars who recognize that the only unit for communion, the only unit for congregational function is the congregation. Now, we often use, and incidentally, while I'm thinking about it, you're not going to hear anything new this morning. The arguments that I'll use are the same ones that we've used for years. Now, I spent maybe a month or two trying to find some new angles on the Lord's Supper, trying to come up with some new approach to it. Folks, there just isn't any. And so what I'll be talking about this morning is things that most of us know and things that we've gone through. We often illustrate the point that we're making here by referring to the Passover feast. Now, Israel was commanded to have a lamb for a house. Exodus, the 12th chapter, verse 3. Speak ye unto all the congregation. That's Israel. That's plural. All the congregation of Israel, saying, in the 10th day of the month, they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for a house. Now, the Passover was not observed nationally. Although the command was to the nation, they observed it by the household. It was simply the household unit that carried out this thing. Now, notice what it says in verse 6 of the Exodus. The first 5 of Exodus 12, it says, your, now that's plural, talking to Israel, your lamb, that's singular, shall be without blemish, a male of the first year, ye shall take it out of the sheep and from the goats. Well, Israel understood that this command to kill the Passover lamb was to be observed by each household. They didn't reason like our brethren do today, our Cups brethren, that you've got many houses in Israel, and therefore you've got to have many lambs, and because you have many lambs, then everybody can have as many as they want to. That's the way they reason. But that's not the case. Although the word lamb is singular, it is used to refer not to the entire nation, but it's used in a household sense. There's not to be more than one lamb to each house. They understood that. They didn't have any trouble with it. So the we in 1 Corinthians 10:16 is speaking about the assembled congregations, the Christians who made up that congregation. And this is just, Paul often does this. He will include himself with those who he's writing to. And I could give you a number of examples of that. I won't take up the time to do it, but it is common for him to do that. And so when he says we, he's talking about we that assemble to observe the communion. So the answer to the question, is the cup plural or singular? It's obviously singular. Now, the second question in regard to 1 Corinthians 10:16 is this. Is the cup one thing and the blessing another? And to answer this, we, I think, need to ascertain what is the cup of blessing. Now, there are several positions, I guess, on this as to what constitutes the cup of blessing. So I want to just go through two or three of them. There may be even more than that. But if you go to scholarship of the day, if you go to commentaries today to find out what the cup of blessing is, you're going to find that the most popular view is that the cup of blessing is the third or sometimes the fourth cup of the Passover feast. It was called in Hebrew a cup of blessing, they say. And when Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, he simply took this third or fourth cup of the Passover feast and used it to institute the Lord's Supper. Now, I will admit this morning that we need to be extremely careful, brethren, when we take positions that go against world scholarship. I think it's a dangerous thing for us to do that. However, in this case, the stance that most scholars have taken on this is based primarily upon assumption. For example, they assume that the Bible teaches that there was a drink element in the Passover feast. They also assume that Jesus observed the Passover with these drink elements in it. And then third, they assume that when Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, he took this cup from this Passover feast and instituted the Lord's Supper. Now, the facts of the matter are this. You can read the Bible 100 times and you'll not find one word about a drink element in the Passover feast. There just simply was not one. Now, the four or five cups that are referred to by scholars were introduced much later in history. And they were simply the tradition of men, the commandments of men. And folks, it's not likely that Jesus, in view of what he said in Matthew, the 15th chapter, the 9th verse, concerning the traditions of men, that he would use those traditions. Because he says there, but in vain they do worship me, teaching for doctrine the commandments of men. I don't think Jesus would have done that. Don't think he would have used a tradition. And I'm not the only one that takes that position. Although it goes counter to most scholarship today, there are a lot of scholars that do not agree with that. For example, in the Expositor's Greek Testament, Mr. G.G. Finley makes this statement concerning, as he put it, the prevalent view that makes the cup of blessing refer to the third or fourth cup of the Passover. Now, this is what he says. He says, such a technical Hebraism, as the third or fourth cup he's talking about, would scarcely be obvious to the Corinthians. Now, the Corinthians were Gentiles. They didn't know about the Jewish traditions. And he says that it would not be obvious to them, and the genitive so constructed is artificial in point of Greek idiom. He's just simply saying that those Corinthians, Gentiles, wouldn't understand what the third or the fourth cup of the Passover, the cup of blessing, as they called it. They wouldn't understand what it was. Now, W.E. Vine says that that's not the case, because, and he refers back over there to the, what is it, the fifth chapter of 1 Corinthians, where it talks about Christ being our Passover. Vine is wrong about that. Christ being our Passover is not a tradition. It wasn't a commandment of men. That was a thought in the Bible. That is the Bible, you see. And I agree with Mr. Findlay that the Corinthians probably wouldn't know what that was if you called it the cup of blessing from the Passover feast. Now, what I'm saying is that when Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, he did not use a cup from the Passover because there was no cup in the Passover. Now, someone says, well, where in the world did that cup come from? Well, I don't really know where it came from. Obviously, somebody brought a cup there that night, and I think it was probably Jesus because he knew what he's going to do. He's going to institute the Lord's Supper. So he brought a cup for that reason. It doesn't have, you don't have to have a Passover cup. But then again, someone says, well, the cup is mentioned there in Luke, the 22nd chapter, verse 17, and he took the cup and gave thanks and said, take this and divide it among yourself. And then in verse 20 it says, likewise also the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the New Testament in my blood, which is shed for you. What is that first cup? Well, it seems to me that both cups, it's just mentioned twice. Luke just mentions the cup of the Lord's Supper twice. In fact, Luke does that often. He just simply generally speaks of it, and then he goes on to be more specific in speaking of the cup. He does that a lot in his writings. So it doesn't seem that it's a problem, at least not a problem to me. Now, you make some of our brethren take that position, and I'm not putting that position down. And that may be your position this morning, but it seems to me that that there was no cup in the Passover. And this is just simply a case of Luke mentioning the one cup twice. But both of his statements refer to the cup in the Lord's Supper. Now, so I've said that the cup of blessing, if it pertains to the Passover, is not correct. That's wrong. Another view closely aligned with this, but I think much closer to the truth, is that the cup of blessing is a cup over which a blessing has been pronounced. The New International Version says a cup of thanksgiving, implying that it's a cup over which a person has offered thanks. Now, this is a little bit similar to that Passover cup, but they break it away. It doesn't have the trappings of the Passover. And as I say, this, in my estimation, is a lot closer to the truth. And it may be exactly what the cup of blessing is. Thayer says that it's a cup, a consecrated cup, over which we pronounce a blessing. In other words, it's set aside for the purpose of communion by offering thanks for it, and is therefore called a cup of thanksgiving or a cup of blessing. Now, there's a third position that I think is my position. I think it is. And that is that the cup of blessing is a cup containing or conferring a blessing. Now, I think I can back that up with some scholarship. You won't be able to back that position up, that it's a literal cup containing a blessing, by much modern scholarship. But some of the older scholars took that position. For example, Olshausen, who is a highly recognized scholar, expressed this view in these words. He says, if we take the cup of blessing, not passively, that is, cup that is blessed, but actively, cup which confers a blessing, the cup of blessing. That was his position. He was saying that the cup contained a blessing, or it conferred a blessing. Godet quotes Henrici, and Henrici's an old scholar. Thayer quotes Henrici, a well-known scholar in the past age. He says in 1 Corinthians 10:16, the cup which contains the blessing of Christ is the cup of blessing. Finley, in the Expositor's Greek Testament that I mentioned a moment ago, says the cup which gives a blessing, for which we give blessings to or thanks to God. And then finally, Joseph Excel in the Bible Illustrator says this of the cup of blessing in 1 Corinthians 10:16. He says, it, referring to the cup, contains the blessing, the long-promised, long-looked-for blessing. The wine in that cup is impregnated with blessing. Now, it seems to me that the idea of all these scholars is that the contents of the cup represents the blood of Christ, and his blood, of course, was shed in his death, which is the source of all of our spiritual blessings. But, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of difference whether the cup of blessing is a blessed cup or whether it's a cup containing a blessing. The cup is one thing and the blessing is another thing. That was the question that was asked. They're not the same thing. But in passing here, let me consider Isaiah 65 and 8. Now, I've always heard that verse of Scripture that it refers to the cup of blessing in the Lord's Supper. It says over there, "Thus saith the Lord, as the new wine is found in the cluster, and one saith, destroy it not, for a blessing is in it." And then we take that blessing is in it and refer it to the contents of the cup. Now that may be, I don't know. But of all the research that I did, and I didn't have time to go into it extensively, but it seems to me that the cup that contains the fruit of the vine that's in the cluster of Isaiah 6:5 really has absolutely nothing to do with the Lord's Supper except that it's the same material. Now, Adam Clark makes this statement about it. He says the cluster must not be destroyed because there is a blessing in it, a nutritional part of it. The blessing is in the nutrition that you get from it, he says. So Israel shall not, and there's a comparison there. He says, so Israel shall not be destroyed because there is righteous people in it. And he's talking about the remnant, that the nation would not be destroyed and the remnant would be saved. And that was the comparison of the blessing. But it's whether it has anything to do with the Lord's Supper. I don't know. I don't understand that it does, really. Okay, so the cup itself and the blessing are two different things. Now, the third question is similar to the second, I'll treat it separately. And that question is the cup and the fruit of the vine the same? Now, our cups of heaven have for years been trying to prove that they are, but 1 Corinthians 10:16 just simply is not a good proof text for it. It's no help whatsoever. Now, there are two or three views here that I probably need to express on just what the cup is and the fruit of the vine is. Thayer says that the cup, in 1 Corinthians 10:16, is a literal cup. He lists it under the word proterion, and it's under the word literal or properly, I think, is the word that he uses. So he considered the cup to be literal there. The popular critical Bible encyclopedia says the cup of wine in the Lord's Supper is called the cup of blessing. It is a literal cup of wine. Robinson states that the cup of blessing is a cup of red wine. Cup of wine. So these scholars indicate that the cup of blessing is a literal cup containing the literal fruit of the vine. Now, there's other views on it. For example, Bauer Gingrich on page 702 cites the word cup in 1 Corinthians 10:16, under the literal use. It's under literal, but then he makes comments down in his commentary there, and he says that it is used by metonymy. Although it's literal, it's used by metonymy, and I'll explain in a minute what he meant by that. R.C.H. Linsky, in his commentary on 1 Corinthians 10:16, says that the cup of blessing is a figure which names the vessel when its contents are referred to. So he, too, is saying that the cup of blessing is a metonymy. Now, these Bible scholars, Linsky and Arndt Gingrich and perhaps others, believe that it's a figurative use. Now, I want to mention one other scholar. I found this a little bit interesting. Bullinger says that 1 Corinthians 10:16 is neither literal nor is it a metonymy. He says it is a metaphor. In other words, it's a comparison, it's a likeness or a representation. And then he goes on to explain what he means by a metaphor. Listen to these words. He says that one thing is another thing owing to some association or connection in the usage of or effect of anything expressed or understood. In other words, he's saying that a metaphor explains a likeness or a representation, you see. Now, he says the two nouns, that is, in a metaphor, a noun representing or a likeness of another noun, must be mentioned And always, now listen to this, must be taken absolutely literal, in a literal sense. And then he says, the figure lies in the verb or copula, which in English must always be expressed and never understood by ellipsis. Now, Christ is a rock. That's a metaphor. Christ is literal, and rock is literal. Now, the figure is in the verb, which is, you see. Herod is a fox. Herod is literal. Fox is literal. The likeness, of course, is in the verb. Now, that's what Bullinger is saying about 1 Corinthians 10:16. Now, notice he translates it on page 741. He says, the cup of blessing, and he says that's literal, is it not, now that's the verb, that's the figure, and he says, does it not represent the communion, is literal, you see, of the blood of Christ. And then he adds, through which all blessings come. Now, the point he's making is that the cup of blessing is literal. Even if it's a metaphor, the cup of blessing is a literal thing. And, of course, the blood is a literal thing. So it doesn't matter really what position you take. They're not the same thing. The cup and what it contains is not the same. Now, I want to get back to the metonymy that Bauer Gingrich mentioned. Now, if it is a metonymy, and I'm inclined to think that it's really a literal thing, but if it is a metonymy, it does not make the cup and the fruit of the vine the same. Now, we all have studied what metonymy is, and I'll just give a couple of quotes here. Bullinger says a metonymy is a figure of speech by which one name or noun is used instead of another to which it stands in a certain relationship. Williams' composition and rhetoric says it's a figure of speech in which an object is presented to the mind not by naming it, but by naming something else that readily suggests it. Now, from this definition of a metonymy, we learn two or three things. First of all, we learn that there's an object name. There's something named, and there's something suggested by that name, and then there is a relationship between those two things. Now, of course, in this particular metonymy of the container for the contents is the cup is named. The cup of blessing is named in 1 Corinthians 10:16. The same thing suggested is the fruit of the vine, and of course the relationship is that the fruit of the vine is in the cup. Now, Irvin Waters, years ago in his debate with Porter, gave some illustrations of what a metonymy is. I'd like to notice these just real briefly. He gives five definitions. He says, in a metonymy, the object is named and not the thing. The object named is not the thing suggested. Now, the thing named, of course, is the cup. The thing suggested is fruit of the vine, and they are not the same. He says, a real object must be named. It's not an imaginary object. Then he says, both the thing named, which in this case would be a cup, and the thing suggested, which would be the fruit of the vine, must exist. And then fourth, he says, in metonymy of the container for the contain, the container name must contain the thing suggested. You can't contain a foreign subject. It has to be what's suggested because of the relationship between. Then he says, one can only suggest the contents of as many cups as he names. In other words, in metonymy, the plural and the singular is not changed. You can't name a singular cup and have a plural content, you see. It's carried through all the way. So in metonymy, the cup, which is the container, is just as literal as its contents, which is the fruit of the vine. The cup is literal, fruit of the vine is literal. Now, the fruit of the vine can be called a cup only because of its relationship to the cup. You do not call grape juice a cup if it's not in the cup, you see. You don't go to the grocery store to buy grape juice and ask for a cup. They would know what you were talking about. The reason it's called a cup is because it's in a cup. And that relationship is there because of metonymy. So in 1 Corinthians 10:16, if a metonymy is used, that is the container for the contents, the cup refers to the fruit of the vine or suggests the fruit of the vine. The cup and the fruit of the vine are not the same. And there's no way that by the rules of language that can be proved. It takes both the cup And it takes the fruit of the vine to make an metonymy. What is in the cup is not the cup itself, by any law that you want to come up with. Well, if the cup of blessing, which I think is a literal cup with fruit of the vine in it, as several scholars indicated, as we already mentioned, it's impossible for those to be the same. If they are literal, a cup, of course, is a solid. And if it is a literal cup, a solid, then it's not the fruit of the vine, which is a liquid. They're not the same. So the answer to the question is, they cannot be. The cup and the fruit of the vine cannot be the same thing. Okay, how much time?
7 or 8 minutes.
Well, let me real quickly go through 1 Corinthians 11:27. 11:27 says, "Wherefore, whosoever shall eat this bread and drink this cup of the Lord unworthily shall be guilty of the body and the blood of Christ." Now, the first question is, do we drink the cup or the contents? Well, clearly the verse says that we drink the cup. Now, the argument is made that because we cannot drink or swallow a literal cup, then this has to be talking about the contents, the fruit of the vine. Now, if that's the case, I don't know why in the world Paul didn't just call it the fruit of the vine. This would have been a perfect place for him to call it the fruit of the vine, but he doesn't. He calls it a cup. Now, there would be absolutely no reason to use the word cup in this context, brethren, unless the fruit of the vine was in it. Now, one of the first rules of language is that you must take a word or words literally unless there's something that forces them to be taken figuratively. And one of the rules that is given by scholars, Dungan and his rules of using a word literally, I think it's rule 5, says that it must be taken figuratively if it creates an impossibility. And of course this creates an impossibility. It's impossible to drink a literal cup, to swallow it. Therefore it has to be understood figuratively. And the figure again that's used is metonymy. Metonymy, one thing is name, which is the cup, to suggest something else, which is the fruit of the vine, which is closely associated with it. Thayer says on page 510, under 1 Corinthians, under the drink, word drink, that drink, he says, to drink this cup, that is what is in the cup. So when Paul says that if we drink this, to drink this cup unworthily, he's talking about drinking what's in the cup. Because in metonymy, one thing suggests the contents only of as many cups as is named. And in the phrase, drink this cup, Paul is saying to drink what's in the cup. The cup of the Lord, brethren, is never an empty cup. And it's never grape juice by itself. It is a cup containing the fruit of the vine. The cup of the Lord is mentioned by the Apostle Paul to suggest its contents. Therefore, we drink the cup of the Lord in an assembly of the church by drinking what's in a cup. It's the only way you can do it. Okay, another question that was asked in regard, that doesn't really have anything to do with 1 Corinthians 11:27, as far as I can see. That is, the question is, does the church in Jerusalem use one cup for our city? I'm not sure just what they wanted to know. If they're saying that they used one cup, and it's called one cup, but there are several congregations in Jerusalem, like Ephesus and Corinth that we studied a moment ago, then of course the answer is they used one cup per congregation. But I think probably what they are talking about here is the old argument that the city, the church of Jerusalem was too large to use only one cup. And a number of cups would have had to have been employed to accommodate that larger crowd. And so, because it had grown to several thousand, we read there in Acts the 5th chapter, how could you use one cup? Well, we're going to have to find scripture. And we're going to have to even find some history that proves that the early church met in large assemblies to observe the communion. And you cannot do it. You can't prove from the Bible that the church communed in audiences of 4,000 or 5,000 people. It's just pure supposition that they did that. And of course, supposition is not going to prove a thing. However, I think that there is scriptural authority for having more than one congregation within a city. But there is no authority for having more than one cup on the Lord's table in a congregation. So that's the crux of it, it seems to me. There could have been several congregations around and in Jerusalem. It's possible that the large crowds that are mentioned in the book of Acts met in homes to break the bread. You know, in the 46th verse of Acts, the second chapter, it says, speaks of the breaking of bread from house to house. And the contrast there is between the public worship of the our assemblies of the temple and the private assemblies of the home. And I believe that it was in this home. And I believe that's a reference to the Lord's Supper. And this, you can prove from scholarship that the early church met in homes to commune. I looked up three or four of them. Alford believes that. The Expositor's Greek Testament believes it. The Pulpit Commentary believes it. Ellicott believes that. And Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, and others. So, obviously, there is some Greek scholarship. Now, I'm not going to have time to refer back to Exodus, the 12th chapter again, but I'll just mention it in passing that one congregation is spoken of observing the Passover meal, and it was eaten in the household situation, in their homes. But in the 12th chapter, the 6th verse of Exodus, it speaks of the whole assembly killing the lamb, singular. A whole congregation, that might have been 2 million people in Israel. But they didn't have any trouble understanding that they did that on a household basis. And that's the way that we observe, that's the way 5,000 people in Jerusalem could observe the Lord's Supper, was in individual assemblies. The last question, what can we scripturally prove and what do we surmise in this regard? Well, we can prove that the church in Jerusalem met to break bread from house to house, verse 42. And you know this verse, rather 46. Now up in verse 42, it speaks of the breaking of bread. They continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and breaking the bread. You know, that word for bread is the bread, having reference to a specific bread. And this leads Bible students to understand that it was the bread of the communion that he had reference to. Now down in verse 46, where it says they broke bread from house to house, it doesn't have the bread. But it's understood that it's the same bread that he's already referred to. So I think that you can prove scripturally that they did observe the communion from house to house. And you cannot prove that they did it in large assemblies.